Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are strapping in for what's really one of the most high-stakes subjects in all of medicine.
Yeah, definitely.
We're talking about the precise, sometimes, well, often frantic, choreography of cardiac arrest response.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for decades, surviving sudden cardiac arrest, it felt almost like a miracle, didn't it? Like something rare, unpredictable.
It really did. But that whole perception, it's dramatically shifted. I mean, now, thanks to, well, rigorous science, training for the public being way more accessible.
Right, and those AEDs everywhere.
Exactly. Automated external defibrillators in, you know, malls, airports, gyms, return of spontaneous circulation, RSE. That's actually the expected outcome now, assuming, you know, a successful resuscitation attempt.
That's a huge shift. Expected, not hoped for.
Precisely.
So what we're really digging into today is how that expectation gets met. It's not just like one person doing chest compressions anymore.
Oh, not at all. It's a complex, synchronized system. We talk about the chain of survival.
Right.
And that chain, it needs everyone pulling together public effort, smart policy design, and of course, a really dedicated team of highly skilled clinical providers.
So our mission today is basically to unpack all those layers for you. We're starting pretty broad, looking at community readiness, the sort of pre-hospital program objective.
The big picture stuff.
Yeah, the strategic goals.
Huh?
And then we'll drill down into the very specific clinical algorithms, you know, basic life support, BLS, and advanced cardiac life support, ACLS.
The step-by-step actions that save lives.
Okay, so let's start right at the top then. Policy level.
Right.
You know, any successful operation, healthcare, business, whatever, it needs clear goals.
Absolutely.
And in emergency medical services, that means setting up those pre-hospital program objectives using that SMART framework.
That's the one. Specific, measurable, attainable, achievable, realistic, relevant, and timely. It's the foundation.
Okay.
Before an ambulance even rolls, the sister itself, the whole emergency system, has to answer some pretty fundamental questions about how ready the community is, how communication works.
Hmm.
Well, for starters, is there a universal access number?
Yeah.
Like 911 or 112? Seems basic, but...
crucial. And what about the dispatchers? Are they trained specifically to give CPR instructions over the phone? Like hands-only CPR?
Exactly. Can they actually talk a bystander through it? And taking it a step further, does the dispatch system use tech to alert nearby folks who are CPR trained?
Mm.
Maybe ping your phone.
Wow, yeah. That could shave off critical minutes, couldn't it? Getting hands on chest faster.
Huge difference. And that loops right back into community involvement. The system needs to ask, is CPR training easy to find? Is it available?
Are we talking about policies like requiring CPR certification to graduate high school? Is that something systems consider?
Definitely. It's a strategy to basically create a baseline of potential responders in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And also, are key public spots, especially places like gyms, fitness centers, are they equipped with AEDs?
And people trained to use them right there.
And people trained to use them instantly.
Okay, but that idea of requiring CPR for high school graduation, I mean, it sounds good on paper, but are we actually seeing that move the needle on survival rates? Or is it more, you know, theoretical?
Well, the sources suggest that kind of mandatory training, it dramatically increases the pool of bystanders who might actually step in. They're willing and, importantly, able to act.
So it makes it less of a specialized skill and more just something people know how to do.
Kind of like a societal reflex, yeah. And this brings up another point about system checks. The analysis doesn't stop when the ambulance leaves. The system has to ask, are all the cardiac arrest calls and the dispatcher audio tapes, are they reviewed by a medical director?
Ah, that quality control loop. Rigorous review.
Continuous improvement, it's key.
And that feedback, that wasn't always there, right? You mentioned quality issues historically. Let's shift gears then and talk about the actual CPR, the core clinical action.
Yeah, speaking of evolution, it's interesting, the sources point out that CPR quality actually kind of dipped back in the 1990s.
It slipped. That sounds alarming. What happened?
It seems related to things like rescuer fatigue, maybe not pushing hard enough, too many interruptions. It wasn't consistent. And that's precisely why there's such a massive renewed focus now on high quality performance in all the current guidelines.
Okay, so that focus is justified because doing it right makes a huge difference.
Huge. Immediate high quality CPR. It can literally double or even triple the survival rate for someone in VF ventricular fibrillation or, you know, sudden cardiac arrest.
So high quality, that means starting fast, right? Like,
yeah.
10 seconds or less to decide if there's no pulse.
Yep, don't delay. Get hands on chest.
And then maintain that standard adult rhythm. 30 compressions, 2 breaths, do 5 cycles of that in about 2 minutes.
That's the bedrock. And, you know, on the airway side, Things have changed a bit, too. There's less emphasis now on rushing to intubate, putting in a breathing tube routinely.
Why is that?
Because the absolute priority is keeping those compressions going. If an advanced airway is needed, like an ET tube or a supraglottic airway, it has to be placed with minimum interruption to compressions. We're talking seconds.
Okay, keep the blood flowing.
That's the goal.
And with the breaths, the ventilation. Control is key, you said. 1 second per breath. Just enough to see the chest rise.
Exactly. And the big warning, highlighted everywhere, is do not hyperventilate. Don't breathe too fast or too hard.
Why is hyperventilation so bad?
Well, basically, when you force too much air in too quickly, it increases the pressure inside the chest cavity.
Okay.
And that increased pressure makes it harder for blood to get back to the heart between compressions. So you end up producing cardiac output, even though you're trying to help. It's counterproductive.
Got it. Less is more, in a way. Just enough air.
Precisely. Visible chest rise, 1 second duration.
Okay, back to circulation then. These advanced theories you mentioned, stressing negative intrathoracic pressure, that comes from letting the chest fully recoil, right? Spring back up.
Yes. That recoil is just as important as the pushdown.
Can you break down why that recoil matters so much mechanically?
Sure. Think of it like bellows, or even a bit like a vacuum. When the chest wall fully recoils after a compression, it creates negative pressure inside the chest.
Okay.
That negative pressure actively helps pull blood from the rest of the body back into the heart, refilling it for the next squeeze. If you don't allow full recoil, the heart doesn't fill properly.
It doesn't matter how hard you push if there's nothing in there to pump out.
Exactly. No filling time, poor output.
And that mechanism, that's why people are looking into devices like active compression, decompression, CPR, ACD, CPR, right? Using a device to help pull the chest back up.
It's based on that principle, yes. But this brings up a really interesting point, maybe even a conflict, regarding technology. There's another device, the impedance threshold device, or ITD.
Right, I've heard of that.
It's designed specifically to work with that negative pressure idea, to kind of enhance the vacuum effect during recoil and boost circulation.
Sounds promising.
It does sound promising. But here's the twist. The American Heart Association guidelines, they currently classify using the ITD during conventional CPR as Class 3.
Class 3, isn't that no benefit or potentially harm?
Class 3 is no benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes potentially harm, but primarily no demonstrated benefit.
Wait, that seems like a major discrepancy. A device designed to help with the very mechanism we just discussed, enhancing negative pressure, is rated as having no benefit in standard CPR. Why? What are the sources saying about why it didn't pan out in trials?
It seems like one of those cases where the physiological theory, how it should work, just hasn't consistently translated into better patient outcomes, like survival, in the big clinical studies when used with standard manual CPR techniques.
So the real-world data just isn't there yet for routine use.
For routine use with conventional CPR, that seems to be the conclusion for now. It's still discussed, still researched, but not a standard part of the toolkit based on current evidence.
Okay, that's a critical nuance. Good to clarify. So let's move from CPR, which is, you know, manually pumping the blood.
Keeping things moving.
To defibrillation, the electrical reset.
Right, the shock.
So defibrillation delivers that electrical jolt to the heart. But it's crucial to remember, it only works for specific rhythms, right?
Absolutely critical. It's only for the shockable rhythms. Ventricular fibrillation, VF, that chaotic electrical activity, and pulseless ventricular tachycardia, EVT, a very fast rhythm with no pulse.
And definitely not useful for the non-shockable ones, systole, the flatline, or pulseless electrical activity, PEA.
Correct. Shocking a systole or PEA won't help. The problem isn't necessarily an electrical chaos that needs resetting in those cases.
Okay, so for the shockable rhythms, the timing is everything, and it depends on whether you saw the person collapse.
Exactly. If you witness the arrest, if you see them go down, the protocol is get the AED on as fast as humanly possible, attach the pads, let it analyze, and if it advises a shock, deliver it immediately.
Why immediately in that case?
Because in those first few moments, the heart muscle itself still has some oxygen and energy reserves. It's more likely to respond successfully to that electrical reset.
Makes sense. But what if you find someone already down? The arrest is unwitnessed, or you know it's been a while, maybe 4 or 5 minutes or longer.
Then the approach changes significantly. You don't shock right away. First, you perform high-quality CPR for about 2 minutes.
5 cycles of 30 and 2.
Right. You do that before attempting defibrillation.
And the reason for that CPR first?
It's strategic. After several minutes without circulation, the heart muscle is starved of oxygen and full of metabolic waste products.
Yeah.
it's not in a good state to respond to a shock.
So the CPR kind of primes the pump.
Exactly. You're giving it a bit of oxygen, clearing out some waste, basically trying to make the heart muscle more receptive, more likely to convert back to a normal rhythm when you finally deliver the shock. Shocking a starved heart often doesn't work.
Okay, priming the heart first if the arrest is prolonged. That's a key difference.
Vital difference.
And we should touch on kids and babies. For the non-professional rescuer using an AED, for children.
Right. If you have pediatric pads and a dose attenuator, something that reduces the energy level, definitely use those for a child.
But what if you don't? Just an adult AED?
If an adult AED is all you have, the guidelines say use it. A shock is better than no shock. Time is critical. Don't waste time searching for pediatric equipment if it's not immediately available.
Okay, use the adult AED if needed. What about infants? Really small babies.
For infants, the ideal setup is a manual defibrillator where a professional can select a very low dose, or an AED with a pediatric attenuator. But again, if all you have is a standard adult AED,
use it,
but place the pads differently. Use the anterior-posterior position, one pad on the front of the chest, the other on the back, between the shoulder blades.
To make sure the pads don't touch and the current goes through the heart.
Precisely. Avoid pads touching on a tiny chest and ensures the energy pathway is correct.
Good details.
Yeah.
And quickly, other special situations for pads. Hairy chest, wet patient, patches, pacemakers.
Yeah, common issues. Hairy chest, shave it quickly if needed for good pad contact, wet patient, dry the chest area before applying pads, medication patches. Remove them and wipe the skin clean before putting a pad there. Pacemaker or AICD, bumps under the skin. Don't put the pad directly over the device. Place it slightly off to the side.
Got it. Attention to detail saves lives. Okay, let's scale up now from BLS, basic life support, to ACLS, advanced cardiac life support. This is where the pros really get into specific pathways.
Right. ACLS essentially splits into two main algorithms based on the rhythm.
Huh?
Shockable, which is VF and pulseless VT, versus non-shockable, which is asystole and PEA.
So let's take the shockable path first, VF or PVT. You've delivered a shock. What happens next?
Immediately after the shock, you go right back to chest compressions. Don't pause to check a pulse or rhythm yet. 2 minutes of high-quality CPR.
Okay, shock, then CPR.
Then after 2 minutes, you pause briefly, check the rhythm on the monitor. If it's still shockable, you deliver another shock and immediately back to CPR.
And drugs come in here too, right? Epinephrine?
Yes. Epinephrine is the main vasopressor. You give 1 milligram IV push, or IO if you can't get IV access, every 3 to 5 minutes throughout the arrest, regardless of the rhythm, actually.
Okay, epi every 3 to 5 minutes. What if the shockable rhythm just won't stop after a few shocks?
That's when you start thinking about antidysrhythmic drugs. After the second or third unsuccessful shock, the guidelines suggest considering amiodarone.
Amiodarone first.
Amiodarone is generally the first-line antiarrhythmic. If amiodarone isn't available, then lidocaine is the alternative.
And you mentioned magnesium earlier.
Right. That's for a very specific type of polymorphic VT called torsades de pointe. If you see that characteristic twisting pattern on the ECG, magnesium is the treatment.
Okay. So shockable. Shock, CPR, rhythm check, repeat, epi throughout, amiodarone or lidocaine if needed, magnesium for torsades.
That's the core loop.
Now the other side, the non-shockable rhythms, asystole or PEA. What's the approach?
Dramatically different, as you said. You continue high-quality CPR, nonstop basically, except for quick rhythm checks every 2 minutes, and you give epinephrine every 3 to 5 minutes.
But no shocks?
No shocks. Electricity won't help a flatline or PEA. The focus shifts entirely.
Shifts to what?
To two main things. Mm. Maximizing CPR quality and, crucially, trying to identify and treat any underlying reversible causes of the arrest.
Ah, the famous H's and T's.
Exactly. Things like hypovolemia, low blood volume, hypoxia, low oxygen, hydrogen ion, acidosis, hyperkalemia, potassium problems, hypothermia, tension pneumothorax, tamponade, cardiac, toxins, thrombosis, pulmonary or coronary. You run through that checklist mentally or out loud as a team.
So for the listener, PEA means there's electrical activity on the monitor, maybe even looks organized, but the patient has no pulse, right? Versus a systole, which is just a flat line.
That's the key distinction. A systole is electrical silence, essentially. Your main hope is amazing CPR and epi might stimulate some activity.
But PEA, the electricity is there, but the pump isn't working.
Exactly. Something mechanical is usually blocking the heart from ejecting blood effectively, even though the electrical signals are firing. That's why finding and fixing one of those H's or T's is paramount in PEA.
Okay, so non-shockable is all about CPR, epi, and finding the why.
Find the why and fix it if you can.
This simultaneous management, drugs, timing, compressions, looking for causes, it really underscores why teamwork is so critical. The scene choreography idea.
Indispensable. And we know, just factually, two rescuer CPR is way better than one rescuer.
And rotating the compressor. You mentioned fatigue earlier. People get tired really fast doing compressions, like within 2 minutes.
Incredibly fast. Even if someone feels fine, their compression depth and rate almost always start to degrade after about 2 minutes. That's why the guidelines are strict. Swap compressors every 2 minutes or every five cycles, even if the person doing compression says, I'm okay.
That discipline is the heart and the heat of the moment, I imagine.
It is, which leads right into the role of the code team leader. They're like the conductor.
The conductor, what does that involve?
Well, the leader needs to be skilled enough to do any task, technically. But their real job isn't usually doing the compressions or bagging. It's oversight.
Stepping back to see the whole picture.
Exactly. They're responsible for the overall timing, 2 minutes up, interpreting the ECG rhythm, clearly delegating tasks. You're on airway, you give the next epi, tracking key metrics like chest compression fraction or CCF.
CCF, what's that?
Chest compression fraction. It's the percentage of time during the code that someone actually has hands on the chest doing compressions. You want that number as high as possible, ideally over 60%, maybe even 80%. Minimal pauses.
Okay, tracking CCF. What else for the leader?
Making the decisions about medications, deciding if and when to transport, and really importantly, fostering good crew resource management, CRM.
CRM. That's about communication, right? Like pilots use.
Precisely. It's about clear, closed-loop communication to minimize errors under stress. Someone gives an order, the person confirms the order, the leader acknowledges the confirmation.
So give 1 milligram epinephrine.
Giving 1 milligram epinephrine.
Confirmed. Like that.
Exactly like that. Reduces mistakes when things are chaotic.
And this is where simulation training comes in, practicing these high-stress scenarios.
Absolutely essential.
Yeah.
Using high-fidelity mannequins, running realistic code scenarios, it helps teams practice these low-frequency, high-risk events, so the choreography, the communication, the skills, they become almost automatic. Reduces cognitive load during a real emergency.
Makes perfect sense. Practice makes permanent, especially under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've covered the system, the CPR, the shocks, the drugs, the teamwork. Now we need to tackle the really difficult part, the boundaries. When do you not start or when do you stop?
Yeah, this is tough but essential. There are situations where starting CPR is clearly futile.
Such as?
Obvious signs of irreversible death. We're talking things like rigor mortis, the body stiffening, dependent lividity or liver mortis, that purplish pouring of blood in the lowest parts of the body. Putrefaction, decomposition, or an injury that's obviously incompatible with life.
Catastrophic trauma.
Right. In those cases, resuscitation efforts aren't appropriate.
And also, if the patient has legal documentation.
Correct. If there's a valid do not resuscitate DNR order present, or similar directives like a MOLST or pulse form, or a specific advance directive stating no CPR, those wishes must be respected. You don't start.
But what if there's any uncertainty, any doubt at all?
Then the rule is, always start CPR. Err on the side of life. If there's any doubt about the DNR's validity or the signs of death aren't definitive, you begin resuscitation.
Okay, start if in doubt. And once you've started, when do you stop? What are the criteria?
You generally continue until one of several things happens.
ROSC,
the patient, gets a pulse back. Or you transfer care to a higher level provider or team. Or the rescuers become physically exhausted and unable to continue safely.
Okay.
Or a physician assumes responsibility for the patient and directs you to stop. Or, finally, those reliable criteria indicating irreversible death become apparent during the resuscitation.
And there are specific protocols for stopping in the field, right, for pre-hospital teams.
Yes. Data-driven termination of resuscitation, TOR rules.
Yeah.
For BLS teams operating alone, they might consider stopping if the arrest was unwitnessed by EMS personnel.
Meaning they didn't see it happen.
Right. And if there's no ROSC after 3 full rounds of CPR and AED analysis,
yeah.
And importantly, no shocks were ever delivered by the AED.
So unwitnessed by EMS, no ROSC after trying, and no shockable rhythm found.
That's the gist for BLS TOR. For ALS teams, the criteria are a bit stricter. Termination might be considered if the arrest was unwitnessed by anyone, EMS or bystanders.
Okay.
If no bystander CPR was provided before EMS arrived, if there's still no ROSC after providing complete ACLS care in the field, drugs, airway, etc., and again, if no shocks were ever delivered.
So similar themes, but with the addition of ALS interventions not working and confirming no bystander CPR.
Correct. And generally, if resuscitation is terminated in the field based on these criteria, transporting the patient to the hospital is usually not appropriate. They're declared deceased on scene.
Unless there are exceptions.
Rare exceptions. Severe hypothermia is a big one. You're not dead until you're warm and dead. Sometimes certain drug overdoses might warrant transport, even after prolonged resuscitation attempts, hoping hospital treatments can reverse the effects. But those are exceptions, not the rule.
Wow. What a deep dive, truly. We've gone from community planning with SMART goals
all the way through the nitty-gritty of shockable versus non-shockable rhythms.
The critical role of teamwork, that scene choreography, and even the heavy ethical boundaries of when to start and stop. Mm-hmm. It really is a finely tuned, incredibly complex system.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
And you know, the one constant, the thread that ties every single part of this together, before the shock, after the shock, PLS, ACLS, community responder, paramedic, is the unwavering need for high-quality CPR.
That just keeps coming back as the foundation.
It's the foundation. It's the single biggest factor we can control immediately that boosts survival. Everything else builds on good compressions and appropriate ventilation.
Which brings us perfectly to our closing thought for you, the listener, to mull over. Given that achieving ROSC is the immediate goal, and knowing how much high-quality CPR relies on human effort, training, and avoiding fatigue, how much further can we push this?
Yeah, thinking about the future.
How much more can advanced simulation training, getting teams even slicker, and maybe the wider use of mechanical CPR adjuncts, like those low-distributing bands or piston devices, how much more can technology and training really push the limits of human endurance and what's possible in pre-hospital care?
It's the next frontier, isn't it? Optimizing that performance edge.
Something to think about. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.